This audio file comes from the Libri Ideas Library at www.libri-ideas-library.org. The library contains over 1,000 lectures and discussions which explore questions about the reality and relevance of Christianity. We ask you to respect the copyright for this audio file, which belongs to Libri Fellowship. The file is for personal use to share with friends, family and colleagues, but please do not publish the material in any format or post it on a website without seeking permission from Libri Fellowship. Please note that views expressed in the lecture and discussion time do not necessarily represent the views of Libri Fellowship.
Before I start though, you're going to have to excuse my coughing and be hacking through the whole thing, but I'll give it a shot anyways. Now, we've got a fair amount of material to cover today, and it's a fairly formal lecture, and I don't think it's terribly philosophical, but there's a lot of material. So, if there's clarification kinds of questions during it, feel free to stop me and ask me what I mean by this, or repeat something, or something like that. That's fine, but if they're questions of discussion kinds of questions, just hang on to them until the end. And I'm not really sure how long this will take me to get through, but the title of the lecture is The Problem with Authenticity, which may sound like a bit of a strange title, but hopefully you'll understand more of what I mean by the time we get to the end of this. Now, one of the words that we hear thrown around a lot in our culture, and I think also probably in certain Christian communities, is this word authenticity. We're told that we need to be authentic people, or we need to be authentic Christians. And this ideal of authenticity, I think, has become one of the chief values in our societies. Now, if you've read any of the material that's come out of the emerging church, a movement in Christianity, kind of a postmodern Christianity, this is a word that you'll come across fairly often. It's a fairly big theme. And so we have these voices calling for maybe something like a return to authentic Christianity. And I think that a lot of the people that come to Libri here are often critical of the Christianity that they've come from, and this is one of the common critiques, is that the Christianity that they've seen is inauthentic, or something like that. So, since this word is used so much lately, what I want to do in this talk is have a closer look at this term and see whether or not our typical understanding of it is a value that we ought to hold, something that we ought to strive for, authenticity. Now, it may seem a bit crazy to some of you, because it may seem so obvious that, sure, of course, authenticity is something that we need to strive for. And in a certain sense, I do want to affirm the value of authenticity, but I think that there may be some problems with our understanding of this term, or at least with some expressions of authenticity. And so I think that it's worth exploring what this word means in our society, what it's come to mean in our own understandings. So we should probably start with a couple of very quick definitions of what the word authentic means. So basically what's usually meant by the word authentic is real or genuine or maybe not hypocritical. And maybe the chief meaning is true to something original. It's this idea of being true to something that I want to explore further today. Because today, many use the word to mean being true to oneself. So like I said, we're going to have a look mainly at this last sense of the word authentic, since this is the meaning that seems to be so prevalent today, the idea of being true to myself. That's what being authentic has come to mean. Now, we're going to be looking mainly at a book by one of my favorite thinkers named Charles Taylor, He's a professor of philosophy and political theory at McGill University in Montreal. And he's one of the top 10 living philosophers today, I would argue, and it's not just me, others would make the same argument. And we're going to have a look at the argument that he makes in this book called The Ethics of Authenticity. And I'm going to be looking at that, but I'm going to be drawing on, I've read a lot of Charles Taylor, and I'm going to be drawing on other things that he says in different places too, because some of what we'll talk about today are themes that crop up in other places in his work as well. So we're going to look at that, and then at the end, this is going to be the trickier part of the lecture for myself anyways, and maybe harder for you to understand, because it's me trying to draw what he has to say in relation to culture at large into specifically more Christian culture. So how it's manifested, how these ideas or problems that he diagnoses have manifested themselves in Christian culture. Okay, so we're going to start by looking at what Taylor describes as three features of modern society that people experience as areas of decline. And we're going to end up focusing on just the first of these, but he talks about these three areas. The first, well, he says that these three areas that people experience, not everybody, but some people experience as decline, and they write books about these things and all of that. These things are sometimes so familiar to us that the familiarity hides maybe our bewilderment over them. So the first source, or the first source of worry, is individualism. And for many, this is what is claimed to be the finest achievement of modernity. Because as a result of it, we have rights that are defended by legal systems in a way that our ancestors could never have imagined. So because of individualism, we're able to control our own lives and to direct them as we see fit. We're able to shape our lives how we choose. And so no one wants to go back from this. And in fact, many desire to see less and less control over our lives by political institutions or institutions of any kind. And it's the individualism that is at the heart of Western liberalism. And if you've taken any courses on political theory or anything like that, you'll have some understanding of what Western liberalism is. It's basically the political ideals that underlie virtually all Western societies. So rights have always been granted to some, but Western liberalism has led us to the conclusion that rights are available to everybody simply on the basis of our being individuals. Now, in the past, so prior to modernism and Western liberalism, we understood social order in terms of something called the great chain of being. That may be a term that some of you are familiar with. The idea that there was a created hierarchical order. And this was reflected in everything, in the cosmos, in society. So you've got God at the top of this order, and then you've got maybe a king, and then royalty, and then wealthy, and then down on to the rest of us, and then beneath all humans are the animal kingdom and things like that. So there's this hierarchical order that shaped the cosmos and shaped our world for us. Taylor says this hierarchical order in the universe was reflected in the hierarchies of human society. People were often locked into a given place, a role and station that was properly theirs, and from which it was almost unthinkable to deviate. Modern freedom came about through the discrediting of such orders. So you understand that. It was just a given that there was this hierarchical order. But that locked people into a given place in society. So if you were a farmer, that's what you were going to be your whole life. There was no deviating from that. That was your role, and you didn't resist that. You just acted out that role. Now, while these things, namely the hierarchical social order, did restrict us, they also gave meaning to the world and to all of our activities. Everything had its significance, given its place in the great chain of being. and the discrediting of this hierarchical order, the great chain of being. I think it was Max Weber who described it as the disenchantment of the world. So with modernity and with the elevation of the place of the individual and the freedoms and rights that came along with that, came the disenchanting of the world. And so there was greater freedom, but Taylor says there was also a loss of meaning, because it was this great chain of being that gave us a context in which to understand ourselves and our roles. Now, whether or not this is a good thing is not the point of discussion here. Taylor simply wants to examine the consequences for human life and meaning. Now, many have thought that the individual has lost something very important along with this sense of cosmic order. People no longer have a sense of higher purpose. And Kierkegaard and Nietzsche were among the earliest thinkers to notice this, to notice that there was a loss of meaning. And Nietzsche describes in Thus Spake Zarathustra, he describes the last man as having no aspiration left but to a pitiable comfort. So people's vision is no longer broad. Instead, we have a narrowing of our focus onto our individual lives. As Taylor says, the dark side of individualism is a centering on the self, which both flattens and narrows our lives, makes them poorer in meaning and less concerned with others or with society. And it seems fairly evident that this is this self-absorption is evident in our societies today. Excuse me. The disenchantment of the world is connected to a second feature of modern society. So this is the second source of worry that Taylor points out. First was the individualism. The second is what he calls the primacy of instrumental reason. By instrumental reason, he means the kind of rationality we draw on when we calculate the most economical application of means to a given end. Maximum efficiency, the best cost-output ratio, is its measure of success. So it's boiling everything down to economic calculations and efficiency being the means to attain every end that we could possibly want. Instrumental reason was able to widen its scope once the old cosmic order was swept away. And in one sense, this is liberating. But there is a growing concern today expressed by people like Taylor that the scope of instrumental reason isn't just widening, but is in fact threatening to take over our lives. The worry is that things that ought to be determined by other kinds of reason, things other than instrumental reason, will be decided in terms of efficiency or on the basis of cost-benefit analysis. So values come to be replaced by the impersonal standards of efficiency. And I think that we could probably all think of examples of this where people have their jobs taken away because it's just not the most efficient way of achieving some sort of economic end. And, you know, I think that this is a bit of an aside, but I do think that this instrumental reason has also entered, this model has entered our churches as well. And I think that I'm sure that others have written on this, but I'm sure that should be maybe a cause for concern. This way of thinking is often connected with technology. If a technological solution can be found, then that is what we should go with. And it's as though we're subject to these impersonal mechanisms, and so we find ourselves sacrificing things like people and the environment, for example. Max Weber describes this as living in an iron cage. And many have drawn the conclusion that we're utterly helpless in the face of things like the market and the state. There's a strong fatalism here that Taylor, among others, wants to resist, both at an individual level, but more importantly at an institutional level. So he wants to resist this fatalism that, we're just subject to the market, to these institutions, to these unseen powers, these forces, and just let them run their course. Instead, he wants to show that, no, these are actually, this is all our doing, our own doing, and maybe we should think about resisting them. That was the second thing. The third thing that Taylor points to is a loss of freedom. And this happens in a couple of ways. First, he claims that a society structured around instrumental reason and individualism places limits on the choices that we can make. Society is set up in such a way that it's very difficult to live a lifestyle that goes against the norm. So, for example, public transportation in America and Canada, at least, has been eroded in favor of the car. So in most places, in many places in North America, it's next to impossible to live and work without access to a car. There's a second kind of loss of freedom, though, and this one is a bit more subtle and probably more dangerous. And it's something that Tocqueville predicted. Tocqueville was a French political writer in the early part of the 19th century who wrote a very famous book called Democracy in America, and it's still a classic. Early part of the 19th century, he went over and visited America and traveled around and wrote this book, Democracy in America, based on his what he saw. And he thought that with increasing individualism, people would be increasingly reluctant to participate in self-government. They'll prefer to stay at home and enjoy the satisfactions of the private life just so long as the government keeps providing these things. This results in what Tocqueville calls soft despotism. It will not be a tyranny of terror and oppression as in the old days. The government will be mild and paternalistic. This is a fairly lengthy quote by Taylor. It may even keep democratic forms with periodic elections, but in fact, everything will be run by an immense tutelary power over which people will have little control. The only defense against this, Tocqueville thinks, is a vigorous political culture in which participation is valued at several levels of government and in voluntary associations as well. But the atomism or the individualism of the self-absorbed individual militates against this. Once participation declines, once the lateral associations that were its vehicles wither away, the individual citizen is left alone in the face of the vast bureaucratic state and feels correctly powerless. This demotivates the citizen even further, and the vicious cycle of soft despotism is joined. So that's Tocqueville's critique of what he saw going on in America, and it's this. He's pointing to this worry about a loss of freedom in the face. So as we focus more on our individual lives, less on our society, our cultures, then what feels, in one sense, it seems as though we should have more freedom just focusing on ourselves. But in fact, we experience less freedom. So these are the three, what he calls, malaises that he's dealing with. They're the fear of a loss of meaning, or what he describes as fading moral horizons, the eclipse of ends in the face of instrumental reason, and thirdly, the loss of freedom. Now, there are many different views on these three things that he's talking about. There are those who think that all modernity has brought about is good, and there are others who say that all that modernity has brought about is bad. So there's lots of debate over things like the goods of freedom, for example. What Taylor's claiming is that the nature of these developments is often misunderstood in these debates, and as a result, the real nature of moral choices to be made is obscured. And what he wants to do is clarify some of these things. Now, in the Ethics of Authenticity, he focuses mainly on the first of these, and that's what we're going to be spending our time on today, is individualism. He does talk about these other two, instrumental reason particularly, in other places, but we're going to be looking more deeply into this notion of individualism. Now, Taylor's resisting a particular kind of claim in his views on individualism. He begins by noting that there have been a number of people, most notably somebody named Alan Bloom. I don't know if any of you have heard of Alan Bloom, who wrote a book called The Closing of the American Mind. It's a very interesting book. And people like Bloom are critical of what they see as the relativism, and particularly the moral relativism of the younger generations of America. relativism isn't just an epistemological relativism, so it just doesn't have to do just with truth and knowledge and things like that. It's also held as a moral position. It's the idea that one ought not to challenge another's values. That is their concern, their life choice, and it ought to be respected. Now, this relativism is an offshoot of the individualism that we've been describing. Everyone has the right to shape their life, to shape their own life, grounded in what they take to be as important to them. People are to be true to themselves and seek self-fulfillment. And no one else can tell us what this looks like. So that's the moral relativism that people like Bloom point at. And Taylor agrees with it to a certain extent. And he agrees with the kind of facile relativism that many people, maybe of your generation, hold to. But what he thinks that he disagrees with the thrust of the argument by somebody like Bloom. He thinks that these people fail to recognize that there's a powerful moral ideal at work here. So this isn't just a kind of bland, empty moral relativism. He thinks that there's a powerful moral ideal underlying this. It's just that it's misunderstood. And the moral ideal, he claims, that underlies this is the ideal of being true to oneself. And this is what Taylor's describing as authenticity. And so this is what lies behind ideas like self-fulfillment. The individualism that is criticized by many as being done so on the basis of being narcissistic or self-indulgent. The idea being that there's no moral ideal at work here. And this is exactly what Taylor is wanting to reject. He says, what we need to explain is what is peculiar to our time. It's not just that people sacrifice their love relationships and the care of their children to pursue careers. Something like this has perhaps always existed. The point is that today, many people feel called to do this, feel they ought to do this, feel their lives would be somehow wasted or unfulfilled if they didn't do it. So that's what's unique today, is his claim. That, yeah, perhaps people have always just, you know, said, okay, I'd rather do this than do that. But he's saying that today, people are willing to do things like this, like, my career comes before my family, not because I just feel like doing it, but because they feel called to it. They feel that this is what they ought to be doing. In adopting the ideal of authenticity, people give support to a kind of liberalism, what he calls a liberalism of neutrality. And what this liberalism holds is that society must remain neutral regarding what constitutes a good life. This is up to individuals to determine, and governments, political institutions, institutions of any kind really need to remain silent on this issue. Discussions about what makes a good life are banished to the margins of political debate. Another thing that contributes to the silencing of these discussions is moral subjectivism, or the view that moral positions are not grounded in things like reason or in the way things are, but are simply just chosen because we find ourselves drawn to one or another. And a third factor that he claims that has obscured the importance of authenticity as a moral ideal has been the way that explanation in social science has been dealt with. And Taylor has a lot to say in other places about the way that social sciences have modeled themselves on the hard sciences. And he says that they miss something very important there. Social sciences tended to shy away from invoking things like moral values in favor of harder, more down-to-earth things. And this is a result of its desire to be just like the hard sciences. There certainly are causal factors here in things like social change and historical factors, etc. But it ignores altogether things like values. Values are things that are subjective, so we just need to leave those to the side. Just look at the hard facts. So social science, he claims, has been part of the problem, part of the reason that these questions and the idea of authenticity as a moral ideal has been obscured. Now, he wants to offer an alternative picture to all of this, one that neither totally supports nor condemns. And to follow him, he claims that you need to believe three things. Firstly, that authenticity is a valid ideal. Secondly, that you can argue and reason about ideals and about conformity of practices to those ideals. And thirdly, that these arguments can make a difference. Okay, so let's take a look at where this ideal of authenticity, how it came to be held as an ideal. Let's look at the source of this. Now, Taylor claims that it was born at the end of the 18th century and builds on earlier forms of individualism. For example, Descartes' disengaged rationality. If you remember my early talk that I gave on postmodernism, we talked a bit about modernism to start with, and Descartes, his starting point for everything was the individual, the autonomous rational individual. So there's also the political individualism of people like John Locke and Thomas Hobbes, which made the person, the individual, prior to their social relations, to their social obligations. So Taylor's claiming that today's individualism builds on these earlier versions, but it changes as well. Today's individualism, he claims, is a child of Romanticism. And Romanticism was critical of Descartes' disengaged rationality. So it was critical of that because it failed to recognize our social ties. And it's interesting to note, I think, that some of these early forms of individualism maintain the importance of our connections to communities and things like that. Now, Taylor sees its starting point in the 18th century notion that human beings are endowed with a moral sense or an intuitive sense of right and wrong. This idea develops in response to the earlier notion of right and wrong being determined on the basis of some rational calculation of consequences. I don't know if you know anything about the study of ethics. There's things like utilitarianism, which your morality is determined by this calculation, or how we ought to act is determined by some sort of calculation. So this turn in the 18th century due to Romanticism is that, no, morality has a voice within. And at first this simply means that being in touch with our moral feelings is a means to the end of acting rightly. But this changes, and being in touch comes to be seen as something that we have to attain to be true and full human beings. The source is no longer God or the good or something else outside of ourselves. It's deep within us. We turn inward and come to see ourselves as beings with inner depths. And this turning inward, that we probably take for granted today, Taylor does quite an extensive job tracing the history of that in his most famous book called Sources of the Self. And at first, this turn inward isn't necessarily understood as in being in conflict with the idea of external sources, like God, for example. And Taylor talks a lot about St. Augustine, who was among the first to turn inward. But Augustine turned inward to find God. Not that he was God, but God was discovered through turning inward and examining one's inner depths. But things do change, and salvation comes to be seen as attained through recovering authentic moral contact with ourselves. And along with this comes what Taylor calls self-determining freedom. And he defines that as the idea that I'm free when I decide for myself what concerns me, rather than being shaped by external influences. So along with this comes this idea of self-determining freedom, which is the idea that when I'm free, I decide for myself what concerns me. Now, these the two things, namely the turning inward and the idea of self-determining freedom, are distinct ideas, but they've developed together and have often had a close relationship. In this context, failing to be true to oneself means that one misses the point of their life, misses what being a human is for that person. And Taylor says, being true to myself means being true to my own originality. And that is something only I can articulate and discover. In articulating it, I'm also defining myself. I am realizing a potentiality that is properly my own. This is the background understanding to the modern ideal of authenticity and to the goals of self-fulfillment or self-realization in which it's usually couched. Now, Taylor asked the question, can you talk in reason to people who are immersed in the contemporary culture of authenticity? Can you talk in reason to people who are deeply into soft relativism or who accept no higher allegiance than their own personal development? So basically he's wondering if we can talk to those who think that values and morality are a highly subjective thing. I'm sure that many of you have had conversations with people that have said, no, what values are my own. I determine what is good for me. Nobody else can tell me what to do. Nobody else can tell me how to act. It's something that I decide. But Taylor says that we wouldn't be able to talk to them if they accepted no moral demands. But it seems as if they do accept some moral demand, and that's the demand of authenticity. So starting from this ideal of authenticity, we can ask two questions. We can ask firstly, what are the conditions in human life of realizing an ideal of this kind? What are the conditions in human life of realizing an ideal of this kind? And secondly, what does the ideal properly understood call for? He claims that the general feature of human life that he wants to evoke is its fundamentally dialogical character. So we come to be full human agents capable of self-understanding through the acquisition of language of all kinds, which are obviously dialogical in character. So basically the point that he's making is that relationships define who we are. And most people might claim that this is the sort of thing that maybe happens when you're very young. So, sure, your earliest relationships may shape who you are. Your parents, your siblings, early teachers, something like that, may shape who you are. But Taylor says that this goes on throughout our lives. Our identity is, he claims, who we are, where we're coming from. As such, it is the background against which our tastes and desires and opinions and aspirations make sense. If some of the things I value most are accessible to me only in relation to the person I love, then he or she becomes integral to my identity. So very simply what he's saying here is that our values are largely determined in the context of our relationships with other people. Now, he wants to take this understanding of the relational nature of selfhood on the one hand and certain demands inherent in authenticity on the other and show that these more self-centered modes of culture are inadequate. So you see what he's doing here? By showing that what it is to be human is to be relational and our values and all that we hold dear are determined in the context of relationships. Well, it seems that there might be a potential conflict with this kind of self-centered mode of authenticity that is so evident in our culture. Now, he deals with this in two ways. He claims that modes of culture that opt for self-fulfillment without regard for, firstly, so these are modes of culture that offer self-fulfillment without regard for the demands of our ties with others, and secondly, the demands of any kind coming from something more or other than human desires, are self-defeating, and that they destroy the conditions for realizing authenticity itself as an ideal. So if we are holding to an ideal of authenticity or self-fulfillment or something that denies relationships on the one hand, the ties or obligations to others, or that denies the possibility of something more or other than my desires as being important, are self-defeating. So we start by taking a look at this second one. What is it that we try to do when we seek to understand ourselves? Defining myself means finding what is significant in my difference from others. So when we seek to understand ourselves, this is what we start with, trying to define what makes me different than everybody else. Now, I may be the only person with 417 hairs on my head, give or take. Or I may be the only person who is exactly my height. But these aren't the kind of differences that we're looking for here. This is different than being able to play the piano unlike anyone else. So some differences have significance, other differences don't. This is where things start to get a bit tricky. Because in our culture, there's a general tendency to see values as subjective, as I've already said. Things have significance not in and of themselves, but because people deem them to have significance, either through their choice or just by feeling as though they're significant. Now, but if we think about this, it seems a bit crazy. Things are significant because of their connection to some larger story. They're not significant just because I like them. I can't just decide that wiggling my toes in warm mud is the most significant action. It would have to have an explanation. Perhaps it connects to the earth in some special way, or to Mother Nature, or the spirit world, or something like that. But if it has to have an explanation, then it's open to criticism. What if the explanation's wrong? Your feeling on its own can't determine what is significant. It's an important point. You need to grasp this. So what he's saying is that, many people claim that things have value just because I like them. They're significant because I choose them, or something like that. And he's saying that that doesn't make any sense, because what we deem as significant always is connected to some bigger story, to some bigger picture. And if it is connected to some bigger picture, then it's open to criticism. We can say, well, actually, maybe you could show that wiggling your toes in warm mud isn't significant because the spirit world doesn't exist, or some other reason. But what he's saying is that things take on significance against a background of intelligibility, or what Taylor calls a horizon. Basically what this means is that things have value in relation to a broader context, something other than just me and my feelings or my choices. Often, though, this background isn't taken into consideration. It's just ignored. Or it's suppressed. We're not going to talk about these background things because it's the choice that matters. So these conversations are often suppressed. Now, he uses the example of the discourse surrounding the value of homosexual relationships. He says, very often what happens, not always, but very often what happens is that the discussion slides towards an affirmation of choice itself, as though all options are equally worthy because they're freely chosen. But this denies the background of significance, where some things are more worthwhile and others are not. And so the choice is reduced to a level of any other preference, like that for taller or shorter partners, or blondes over brunettes. And this is what happens when choice becomes the crucial justifying factor. It can't just be assumed that anything we choose is all right or of value. What happens is that the assertion of value becomes conflated, or he uses the term contaminated, with self-determining freedom, an idea that is closely interwoven, as we've seen, with this ideal of authenticity. Now, if we want to defend authenticity, we have to avoid this. It may be important and significant that I determine the course of my life through self-determining freedom, but this is dependent on a larger story independent of my will. The idea that there's something noble or courageous and therefore significant in giving shape to my life. Self-choice is an ideal, not because I feel that it is, but because of something bigger than me. So we see that self-choice doesn't stand alone. It requires a horizon of issues of importance, which help define the respects in which self-making is significant. So he's not denying that self-choice is an important thing. He's just saying that it needs to be put in a bigger context. It's not just, it's not just choice that is of value. Choice is of value because of something else. It's set in this bigger context. What this means is that I can only define myself, my identity, against the backgrounds of things that matter. But if I bracket out everything outside of myself, I would eliminate all candidates for what matters. Authenticity in this view is not the enemy of demands that come from outside of oneself. In fact, it presupposes such demands. So this is the kind of authenticity that he is claiming is a good thing. He's just saying it doesn't eliminate demands that come from outside. That's often how it's expressed in our culture today. That demands, any external constraints impose limits on me and crush my authenticity. He's saying, no. It has to presuppose these demands that come from outside, or these external constraints. Next, we move on to Taylor's other question. Whether or not there's something self-defeating in a mode of fulfillment that denies our ties to others. So we ask the question, whether or not there's something self-defeating in a mode of fulfillment or authenticity that denies our ties to others. And he quotes a fairly lengthy quote from what was a fairly famous book, I think, by Gail Sheehy. It's called Passages, Predictable Crises of Adult Life. And she says, you can't take everything with you when you leave on the midlife journey. You're moving away from institutional claims and other people's agenda, away from external valuations and accreditations. You're moving out of roles and into the self. If I could give everyone a gift for the send-off for this journey, it would be a tent for tentativeness, the gift of portable roots. For each of us, there is the opportunity to emerge reborn, authentically unique, with an enlarged capacity to love ourselves and embrace others. The delights of self-discovery are always available. Though loved ones move in and out of our lives, the capacity to love remains. So Taylor quotes this as an example of how many think about this ideal of authenticity. The idea that connections with others are going to come and go. Love for others, loved ones will come and go in our lives, but it's the capacity to love that remains. And so it's very focused on, centered on the self. And I think this is an obvious point of criticism. Now, we have to be careful not to forget that there are different forms of individualism. There's an individualism which has no social ethic. But the individualism that's connected with the authenticity that he is describing and endorsing even is, must propose, he would argue, some sort of ethic regarding how the individual ought to live with others. And so he claims that it's important to keep, to maintain this distinction. So individualism isn't necessarily wrong. Many good things, human rights, for example, freedom that we all enjoy, all of these things have come from a form of individualism. But he's simply making the claim that it needs to be linked up to some sort of social ethic, and possibly even needs to be presupposed by some sort of social ethic if it's going to be part of being truly authentic. Taylor goes on to describe what he calls a culture of narcissism, a culture in which self-fulfillment is the major value in life, and that recognizes few moral demands or serious commitment to others. He says, I am saying that we should see this culture as reflecting in part an ethical aspiration, the ideal of authenticity, but one that doesn't license its self-centered modes. Rather, in light of this ideal, these appear as deviant and trivialized modes. So, what he's looking for is an answer to the question as to why the culture of narcissism consistently falls below its ideal, and why it's so prone to deviation into the trivial. So I guess the question is, why does the ideal of authenticity seem to always slide into self-centeredness? And I think this is the important question here that he's trying to address. What is it? What's wrong with our understanding of authenticity that leads it to always slide into this self-centered way of being, which I think we ought to be critical of? It's more than simply the fact that we have to choose between our own interests and external constraints, because as he's already said, something like this has always existed. So people have always had conflicts between what I want and what those around me are asking of me. There's always been this kind of conflict. What Taylor wants to explain is why these external constraints are now so easily dismissed. They're just set to the side now. The simple answer, he says, is social change. Ways of thinking become entrenched and seemingly inescapable. Modern individualism began in the 17th century, and as he describes it, it gets changed a bit in the 18th century. But initially, when individualism began in the 17th century, this would have gone against the grain. But then over time, it became the norm. And this can help explain the side of self-centeredness. People tend to center fulfillment on the individual, making one's affiliations merely instrumental, he says. And they tend to see self-fulfillment as just of the self, neglecting or delegitimating the demands that come from beyond our own desires or aspirations, be they from history, tradition, society, nature, or God. Now, he blames this in part on industrialization, which created the need for greater mobility, and therefore we end up with a breakdown in old ties to communities, things like that. And he also blames our technocratic, bureaucratic society, which again, he comes back to his critique of instrumental reason. The bureaucratic society values this above all. So our ties to others are seen instrumentally. Now, these are the external reasons, but he also points to two internal reasons. And I think these are key. So again, we're looking for an answer to the question as to why external constraints on us are so easily set to the side. The first one is the slide towards self-centered modes of the ideal of self-fulfillment in popular culture. And the second one is a movement of high culture towards a kind of nihilism or negation of all horizons of significance. And this he blames on Nietzsche and a number of postmodern thinkers following him. And what I take him to be saying here is that some of these thinkers following Nietzsche have claimed that these horizons of significance, which determine values for us, are nothing more than contingent human constructions. And so they're kind of reduced down to, they're relativized, I guess. So therefore, values can be relativized. And he goes on into a lot of detail that we're not going to get into here. But he does make an interesting point that authenticity, through all of this, comes to be seen as its own goal. Things like self-truth, self-wholeness, and self-fulfillment come to be seen not as means to being moral, but as something valuable for its own sake. So self-fulfillment comes to be seen not any longer as a means to some other end, namely to being moral, comes to be seen as an end in its own. Self-fulfillment is seen as something greater than morality because it focuses on what we are. Morality in modernity came to be understood simply as something that we do. Initially, it was understood that these two things could dovetail, namely authenticity and morality, but in separating them, it allows them to eventually be pitched against each other, which is what we often see today. So morality itself can come to be seen as a stifling convention on our own self-fulfillment. That's an important separation that happens there. What gets separated is the idea of self-fulfillment or authenticity from morality. And as soon as the two things become separated, then they can start being pitched against each other. And because authenticity focuses on what we are, tends to be elevated above morality. So morality comes to be seen as what he calls a stifling convention on our self-fulfillment. And he combines this with his understanding of the postmodern delegitimizing of horizons of significance. And he sees some dangerous results. He then connects this all up with radical self-determining freedom. And this has been a part of authenticity since the beginning, and the connection is obvious. Authenticity is itself an idea of freedom. It involves my finding the design of my life against the demands of external conformity. So we have this basic connection, but the problem is that the notion of self-determining freedom, pushed to its limit, doesn't have any boundaries. There are no givens that one has to respect. And again, we run into the separation of authenticity and morality, and we can see the potential problems there. So authenticity cannot go all the way with self-determining freedom, because it then undercuts itself. And this, he claims, is the case today. He claims, too, that as a result of this, the horizons of significance have become fainter as the appeal of self-determining freedom becomes greater. Choice itself becomes the major value of our culture. Now, in terms of critiquing all of this, what Taylor suggests is that instead of just criticizing the culture of authenticity, he suggests that we identify and articulate the higher ideal behind the more or less debased practices, and then criticize these practices from the standpoint of their own motivating ideal. That was a quote from him. So what he's saying there is that in order to critique this, what we need to do is go back and understand what this and articulate what authenticity is, what it started out as. And then we look at the practices that people do in the name of authenticity and see if they line up. And he's saying that no, this ideal of authenticity is good in and of itself, but what's happened is we've seen some of this separation of, we've seen the separation of it from morality, how that came about, and how some of these, the break with social ties and all of these things, and he's saying that actually when this happens, it undercuts authenticity, and authenticity as an ideal gets lost. So what he's saying is that the struggle ought not to be over authenticity. So we shouldn't argue whether or not authenticity is a good thing. But he's saying that the struggle ought to be about authenticity, defining its proper meaning. Authenticity is, or at least ought to be, a good thing. It allows us to live a fuller and more differentiated life, more fully our own. And Taylor talks about the advantages of his view in terms of bringing about change. This is a quote. The perspective is different if you see these developments in the light of the ethic of authenticity. For then they don't just represent a shift in value that is unproblematic for the people concerned. Rather, you see the new self-centered practices as the site of an ineradicable tension. The tension comes from the sense of an ideal that is not being fully met in reality. And this tension can turn into a struggle where people try to articulate the shortfall of practice and criticize it. So he's saying, again, the practice just is not lining up with a true understanding of the ideal. And so there is a place where we can actually start talking about these things and hopefully bring about change. Taylor claims that it's important in our critique to maintain a distinction between the manner and the matter of action, between the manner and the matter of action. Authenticity is necessarily self-referential in its manner. This has to be my orientation. But Taylor claims this doesn't mean that its matter also needs to be self-referential. He says that my goals must express or fulfill my desires or aspirations as against something that stands beyond these. I can find fulfillment in God or a political cause or tending the earth. Indeed, the argument above suggests that we will find genuine fulfillment only in something like this, which has significance independent of us or our desires. So he says that to confuse these two things closes off the way ahead that he has suggested, and it lends legitimacy to the worst kind of subjectivism. Now, I want to turn to, just for the last few minutes, to maybe how some of this has manifested itself in Christianity. And I'm hoping that when I finish, maybe we can talk about this more and maybe you can help me clarify this. If things become a little less clear here, because I'm trying to bring what I think is Taylor's very coherent and persuasive argument to bear on some observations, fairly loose observations that I've made about Christian culture. And it's sort of a somewhat random collection of thoughts that I had as I was working with this material. As I said, I'm hoping that maybe in the discussion you can help me solidify some of these things. Now, I'm going to be sort of talking about this under two headings of individualism and self-fulfillment, these things that are so tied with authenticity. Now, as I often say, Christianity doesn't exist in a bubble. Christianity will always necessarily be shaped by its surrounding culture. And while this is necessary and sometimes good, we need to make ourselves aware of the worldviews of our cultures in order to see the impact that it has on our understanding of our Christianity or faith. We need to develop our critical faculties in order to see if our worldviews sometimes are where they distort the message of the gospel. I'm not saying that this can be done fully or perfectly, but it can be done to some extent. And I think it needs to be done to some extent. Now, I share Taylor's concern regarding some of the problems associated with the individualism that exists and seems so rampant in our society today. I also think, though, that some of these problems of individualism have manifested themselves in much of Western Christianity. And I worry that Christianity in our culture is far too focused on the individual. Now, I don't have the data to back up this claim, but I'm going to make it anyways. I suspect that the emphasis on, and possibly even the phrases, my personal relationship with Jesus, or my personal salvation, I think that these are relatively new phrases, expressions, perhaps even less than 100 years old. Now, don't get me wrong, I'm not saying that these notions aren't biblical or that they ought not be a part of our understanding of Christianity. I'm simply saying that this is what Christianity seems, in my mind, to have come to be about. Me and my personal relationship with Jesus, my personal salvation, it's all about me. So first and foremost, it's about me, nothing else. And as Taylor noted, in society, our ties to others, to our communities, traditions, to our neighbors, etc., become seen as merely instrumental and secondary. And what we do in many of our understandings of Christianity is we fail to see the bigger picture. We fail to see that being a Christian is aligning ourselves with God's covenant people, and it's to participate in God's redemptive work in His creation. So my personal salvation is a result of this wider participation. It isn't about me, first and foremost. Now, I think that we can maybe talk about some of the manifestations of this in terms of, I don't know, things like people going to this church this Sunday, this church this Sunday. You know, church is about me finding the right programs for me and my family. It becomes all about me and having my needs met. What I get out of the praise service or something like that, the worship service, it becomes very self-centered. Now, this narrower understanding of what it is to be a Christian is closely linked with the ideal of self-fulfillment. If, as Taylor argues, self-fulfillment is such a strong ideal in our society, then Christianity can easily come to be understood as a means to attain self-fulfillment. So Christianity comes to be seen as a means to a self-centered end. And I think that this ought to sound problematic to us. Perhaps we recognize that, but I also think that's a bit of a problem. Now, again, don't get me wrong. I think that we can only find real fulfillment through Christianity. But I worry that Christianity is all too often sold as a sort of ultimate self-help program. Become a Christian and your life will become better. And I'm not entirely sure that that's the message of the gospel. In our culture of authenticity, doing anything other than what I want to do is seen as hypocritical. It's acting inauthentically. And in this we see a focus on action. Authenticity is centered on acting a certain way, a way that is true to oneself. And we've seen in Taylor that a certain notion of freedom can undercut true authenticity. Now, I've lectured in the past on this notion of freedom, and I want to come back to it here just for a second. I would argue that in our culture, we seem to operate with an understanding of freedom that is sharply at odds with a truly Christian notion of freedom. Freedom, in most of our understandings, is largely centered on acting a certain way, in a way free from external constraints, rather than what I would argue is a more Christian understanding of freedom, a state of being free, namely free from the bonds of sin, and free to be a particular kind of person. So our focus is mainly on doing or not doing certain things, rather than on being a certain kind of person. And so this focus on doing certain things and not doing other things, I think, easily degenerates into legalism. Now, there's often a strong tension in Christianity between freedom on the one hand and legalism on the other hand. On the one hand, we don't want to do things with the wrong motives, things that we really don't want to do. We want to be free. And yet, on the other hand, we ought to act certain ways as Christians. And I think that legalism is such a strong temptation because it makes things easy, it makes things much less complicated. We just simply follow a set of rules. But I also think that much of our confusion about these terms stems from a wrong understanding of freedom. We operate with an understanding of freedom that Taylor identifies as undercutting the possibility of achieving true authenticity. True authenticity or self-fulfillment is achieved in relation to what we might call the external constraints of things like Christian community and tradition, our neighbors, and God. So true authenticity is achieved in relation to these things. Because of the way that we've come to understand these ideas, something about this may sound wrong. How can self-fulfillment come about in relation to external constraints, to external demands placed on me? How can I be authentic and find self-fulfillment in relation to anything other than myself? I think that Taylor shows pretty persuasively why we've come to think like this and how it is ultimately self-defeating. True Christian authenticity cannot be separated from morality as it has become in our culture. Morality needs to be understood as not simply acting in a certain way in a given situation. Rather, it needs to be focused on being a person of Christian character. And to achieve this, we need to adopt a different understanding of freedom. And I think that all of this needs to be developed not on our own, but in the context of relationships, ties to our communities, traditions, those around us, and to God. So that's all I have to say.